Football, and sport in general, can often seem insignificant. Certainly to its biggest naysayers it can be, but also at times, in the face of true darkness, despair, low moments, suffering, division, hate and prejudice. Worse still if those in charge of the sport turn a blind eye to injustice, or even more so, choose the wrong side when a better option is presented to them. Insignificant in the face of tragedy, perhaps, the pain of lost friends and idols, the shock of enviable lives cut short in their prime. But a moment in time, however devoid of joy and hope, cannot tell a whole story. Take it to its end, to its conclusion, when triumph and togetherness have replaced the hopelessness.
Destiny has smiled on Zambia, 19 years on, but the scene of their greatest tragedy has become the scene of their most wonderful success.
Where imperialistic shackles are thrown off, and a continent has grown together with its favourite sport showcasing it, when a rainbow nation rises as one and shows the world what it can do as a whole, when new heroes rise, inspired by their fallen predecessors, and within a mile of where the darkest moment in time played out. Football can rebuild, football can unite, it can astonish, inspire and spark so much joy. It can create legends. Roger Miller, Abedi Pele, George Weah, JJ Okocha, Samuel Eto'o, Didier Drogba, Mohamed Salah. Can confuse at times, confound and frustrate, but be redeemed by moments of unthinkable beauty on the field. It's politics, it's pride, it's tears and joy, it's dominance and it's underdogs. It's Africa, it's the Cup of Nations, and it's here. This is the Sporting Almanac Podcast.
Hello, mate.
Hello, Ben. How are you?
Yes, I'm good. I'm enjoying the darts. Alexandra Palace. Paul Lim, the slinger.
Paul Lim. Ah, oh, fantastic. Age is no barrier, people. What are you doing retiring in your 60s? Keep going.
Yeah.
Scale new heights.
Oldest player and therefore now oldest winner in the first round.
Indeed.
At the World Championships. The Wasp.
Easy second round tie as well.
Oh, who did he get in the second seat?
Luke Humphries.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so see you later, Paul. It's been fun.
Nice seeing you, mate.
The Wasp taking centre stage. A couple of meltdowns, people punching tables. A couple of shocks. Not as many as there has been in the past, but shocks nonetheless.
Yeah, there's always at least one or two. Across 64 matches, after all.
Yeah. Huge first round.
There are many more to come.
The Adelaide is going kind of exactly as I expected Adelaide to go.
I wasn't expecting there to be controversy like that. Snickometer not working.
Yeah.
In Australia, conveniently. Yeah. Had to find a new way to cheat, didn't we?
I'm not sure we can clutch at those straws.
We will. People are, I can assure you.
Yeah.
You read the text on the BBC website.
I think we're in big trouble.
Yeah.
We have only scored 334. That's our highest innings total. From the previous four innings we've attempted, that's the only time we've been past 300. By the time this goes out, we may have proved our doubts wrong, but I think it's highly unlikely. So let's move on from that. Any other sports before we turn to football, back to the safety?
The only other thing definitely worth mentioning is, obviously, last week I mentioned Philip Rivers getting called up and placed in a practice squad. I was genuinely not expecting him to be starting this weekend, but start he did. Throw a touchdown pass he did, and win he did not, unfortunately.
Nice transition.
The Colts still lost. Yeah, never mind. They're still in it. I said they were 8-4 last week. They're actually 8-5 then. They're 8-6 now. They're in a good position, but they're going to have to win at least one more game, probably two more games to get into the playoffs. But, you know, if they can do that, once they get in the playoffs, anything can happen.
Yeah, that's true. And there is one team that was not going to be in the playoffs.
Indeed. Kansas City Chiefs. And Patrick Mahomes might not be, walking for a while, unfortunately. ACL injury.
ACL, big one.
He was overdue a big injury in the sense he's 30 years old and he hasn't really had one particularly. He's had a few minor ones. But yeah, if you're a Chiefs fan, it sucks. everyone else is probably getting a bit of schadenfreude out of it, but that's only because, you know, they've been so good. It's going to be a completely different thing without them, because where do you put your money now?
He'll probably be back. He'll be back for next season. The wonders of modern medicine.
Yeah, yeah. Not a career-ending sentence anymore by any means, but, you know, a bit of mobility loss. He'll have to adapt his game, which he will. He's got the arm to do it, so it'll be fine. They'll probably win it next year.
Probably. Let's turn our gaze then. Turn our gaze association footballwards. Etana Bonmati, again, the women's best player in the world. Usama Dembele winning the men's world best player to go with his Ballon d'Or, won earlier in the year. Very controversial. Very controversial, because there is a guy who's probably going to feature in this episode who is probably worthy of that award this year.
Obviously, they do give a lot of credit to winning the Champions League in it, or individual competitions. I don't want it to always to be the Champions League winner, the best player on the Champions League winner wins the Ballon d'Or. I think Mo Salah was much better than him last season.
Yeah, he was.
I think Mo Salah was incredible last season.
He was.
Hasn't been this season, but, you know, not tracking back enough, is he?
Yeah, got to cover your right back, apparently.
Don't even get me started. Anyway,
so before we get back to Mo and Africa specifically, let's just quickly mention that St Mirren won the Scottish Cup, because that's funny and amazing.
Seriously cool, though. It's been not a good start to the new Celtic manager, whatever his name is.
No. Is it Nancy?
Not a good start at all.
Mr. Nancy?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's having a bad time. We'll see if Hearts can do it. But
I hope so. It's been so long.
There's a long way to go.
It's been so long. 40 years is a long time to wait.
St Mirren, though, congratulations.
Huge congratulations to St Mirren.
Yeah.
I didn't expect that. Did not expect that.
Neither did I.
Even when they scored the early goal.
No. And it was a battering. But to divert us back to international football, I don't think we mentioned the World Cup draw took place, and England.
I don't think we care that much.
Well, and also it took forever. It was the most excruciating exercise of all time. But Panama, Croatia, and Ghana for yours truly.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been there would have been some jeopardy there, because obviously Ghana and Croatia particularly are very, very good footballing teams. England should still beat them, but they're very good football teams, and under pressure in the heat, you never know what might happen. But it just takes all the jeopardy out of it that England basically just need to beat Panama and they're probably through, thanks to the best third place teams getting through
for
the
sure.
group stage.
Yeah, as long as they don't get battered by someone, which is very
unlikely. Which is nonsensical.
Yeah, yeah. So
I've ranted to you about this many times in the past. I will save my breath this time, but that is not a good system. You need to keep the jeopardy in it. They had a perfect system in the 1982 World Cup. They could have just doubled.
You're going to hate it, mate, because today's tournament has the same.
It is, yeah. Yeah.
Has the
I hate
same
24
mode.
Team tournaments.
Yeah.
I hate the fact the Rugby World Cup has gone to 24 teams as well. You need jeopardy. You need, like, in the Rugby World Cup, England losing against Wales and getting knocked out. That's the jeopardy. In the Football World Cup, Germany getting knocked out in the group stage. Two tournaments in a row getting knocked out in the group stage, including that incredible last day seesaw with Costa Rica and Japan. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I don't disagree. I know you're preaching to the choir here. So, but that does lead us in very nicely to explain, as people have probably gathered from A, the title of the episode, and B, the introduction, we are discussing all things Africa, and specifically the African Cup of Nations, affectionately known as AFCON.
AFCON, which is easy to say.
Rolls off the tongue.
AFCON by CAF. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what is there to say as a introduction? It's the biennial international men's tournament for African football. As you've already said, it's sanctioned by CAF, which is officially called the Confederation of African Football, held every 2 years, which is unusual.
It is unusual, and a bone of contention for a lot of big European clubs who, of course, have to lose their star players every 2 years. You generally speak during the football season.
Well, I was going to ask you, that was going to be my first question. So it is famously played in the winter, hence the reason why we're discussing it so close to Christmas in December for those who live in the Northern Hemisphere. Well, what are your feelings towards that? Because I looked into this a lot, and I learned a lot about it that I hadn't appreciated before, which is never discussed in the discourse on our television.
So there's a couple of things. First of all, if you were to host it during the Northern Hemisphere summer, you would basically eliminate any West African country from hosting it,
yeah,
because they get so much rain that time of year. It is just completely unseasonable. You cannot play football in those conditions. The further east you go, it gets a bit better. And obviously, south and north is a little bit different climate. However, did you know that since 2019, these should all be held in the summer? They changed it in 2019 to make it so they should all be hosted in the summer.
Yeah.
2019 was hosted in the summer, yeah, and it was okay by all measures. 2021 was due to be hosted in Cameroon, and as mentioned, as a West African country, that wasn't possible. So they moved it to January, February 2021, as it was previously. That was then moved back to 2022 because of COVID. Then 2023 was due to be hosted in June 2023, but that was in the Ivory Coast, which again is a West African country.
Rains.
So instead of moving it forward this time, they just straight away moved it back. So the 2023 tournament was actually held in 2024 in January, February. And then this tournament, it was due to be held. It's in Morocco this year, as mm-hmm. you mentioned. It was due to be held in the summer again. But this time, FIFA decided to host their definitely not pointless in the slightest Club World Cup, which was held over the summer. And that has pushed this back. So the 2025 tournament is now being held in from December to February 2026.
Yeah, and it's supposed to, I think it's obviously 2029 is supposed to be officially going back to the summer.
2027 should be. 2027's in Kenya, Tanzania, and Uganda, which is on the east coast of Africa. And therefore, they've got a bit more of a chance of holding in the summer. But honestly, my money's on January 2028 for that one.
Yeah.
So not... Not only have they not held it in the summer, they haven't even held it in the right bloody year since 2019.
Yeah, that's it. You covered all bases, really, mate. I guess the only thing that I'd add to that is that the Northern African sides do country sides. They're not just sides, they are countries. They
are very successful countries.
Yeah, they're very successful, and we'll get into that. Very hot.
Yes.
So, yeah, it's all politics, basically. Club money, club power, European audiences, to be fair, you know, a lot of European countries have big African communities as well. It's the biggest footballing audience in the world, probably, at least internationally speaking, probably the most diverse.
Certainly some of the most, yes, very, very diverse, very, very passionate as well.
Yeah. You have a lot of North African and, well, all types of African people living across Europe, actually. I was going to say North African mainly because of France, but I would, that would be narrowing the pool unnecessarily.
Indeed.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, we've got that out of the way and hopefully educated some people on why it's hosted in the winter, because it's never really explained. It's just like, oh, why do they upset our club teams? And it's like, well, because there's way more going on than just...
It also started in the 1950s, which we'll come to. And that was a time where there weren't many African players playing in Europe. And if they were playing in Europe, they probably weren't traveling home very often to play international matches.
Yeah, that's true.
It was only four
confederation like it involved in it as well. So like you said it was set up in the 50s, but you also only had four nations that formed part of it.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So like it now,
yeah,
like,
originally.
So it wasn't really considering like club timetables, all that
stuff. No, it was only really the 80s, first few coming in, so Belgium was popular bringing players in at that time, but certainly the 90s. Obviously, you start getting your first sort of superstars emerging in Europe from Africa in the 90s, most notably, obviously, George Weah, Ballon d'Or winner 1995, obviously Samuel Eto'o as well, and, I mean, plenty of other players. You can name JJ Okocha.
Oh, mate.
Nwankwo Kanu.
I've got some names here. Yaya Nkolo, Toure.
Yeah.
Mo Salah, Riyad Mahrez, Loren, Solomon Kalou, Drogba.
Didier Drogba.
Yeah, Andre Ayew.
Got a big soft spot for Didier Drogba, even though he's a Chelsea player.
Oh, same. Absolute great player. Gun player. Asamoah Gyan, Didier Zakora, Max Gradle, Roger Miller. Oh, God. Sean Bartlett, Benny McCarthy, yeah. Vincent Aboubakar. You've already mentioned JJ.
Lucas Radebe.
Oh, Lucas Radebe.
Phil Massinger, the late, great Phil Massinger.
Frederic Canute, Wilfred Bony. Just chucking names at you here.
I'd love this. It's just the rest of the episode.
Yeah. Like we could do it, though. Jovinho and the forehead.
Yeah.
Julius Agahawa.
Fanidi George.
Oh, Fanidi George. God, this tournament is stacked. Like, seriously. Rigobert Song. Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang. Like, yeah. I mean, the Cameroon side of the 2000s to 2010, that period, I'm sure we'll discuss them. But, like, that team was absolutely loaded. Lots of Premier League mainstays, lots of guys that have done it all over Europe, done it all over the world, won the biggest prizes. It's a really good tournament. It's a really good tournament.
Yeah, yeah. There's still only been one African footballer, I believe, unless I'm forgetting anyone, to have won the Ballon d'Or, which was George Weah.
Yeah, George
obviously,
Weah.
Chance to get another little rant in the fact that Mo Salah didn't win it last year, but we'll let that go.
Mo Salah should have won it. If not last year, then on previous occasions. It's been a bit ridiculous recently.
Yeah, indeed. Obviously, there have been players of African origin who ply their trade in France, most obviously recently, Dembele being one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
One of its most famous sons of Algerian descent actually played for France.
Indeed. Indeed.
Zinedine
Zidane, for whom I will mention later for no reason whatsoever. Apropos to nothing, I've got a mention of him.
Yeah, I mean, like, look, what we're really doing here is we're just trying to illustrate that, like, it's worth tuning into because it's a great tournament. It's often quite entertaining. Not always, like, but then no tournament ever is always entertaining. And you're going to see all the stars that you're familiar with in the Prem and across Europe. Yeah, and you'll probably come across some people that will go on to be stars in the Prem and across Europe. So
it often is the case with major tournaments, yeah.
Yeah.
You impress at major tournaments and then you find yourself getting a contract at a big club on the back of it.
So where
and building a career from there.
Where did it all start, though? Because, you know, it's quite a new tournament, relatively speaking.
It is quite new, relatively speaking. I mean, football's been played in Africa. I barely even have to tell you the backstory of how football got to Africa in the first place. I'm sure you can work out whose army and whose soldiers first played football in Africa against the, probably not locals, probably colonial settlers at that point, because obviously this would be in South Africa, the first place it was played, in the 1860s. So that was British soldiers playing with civil servants and playing with settlers there primarily, while some of the local Africans watched, and obviously they picked up the game sort of secondhand. As we've mentioned thousands of times, it's such an accessible game. As long as you can make a ball out of something, you can play football.
Yeah,
and it obviously became extremely popular, not just with the white settlers in South Africa, but also with the locals, and it remains to be so to this very day. And I'll come to a bit of South African history on the subject in a bit. But I think one thing that's sort of important to note from the start, it's football in Africa came relatively late as an organized thing.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a very, very easy reason to explain that. Because until the end of the 1950s and 1960s, there really weren't that many countries in Africa, or certainly independent countries, I should say, in Africa. So
politics. Politics and good old-fashioned racism.
Colonialism as well. So as of 1950, and bear in mind this is when the fourth World Cup was taking place in Brazil at the time, there was only three fully independent nations in Africa at that point, which was Liberia since 1847. It was originally a colony of formerly enslaved African Americans, and it was supported by American independence, was protected largely by America, hence why it stayed independent even as Europe was swallowing up the rest of Africa. And then there was Egypt, which gained its independence from the United Kingdom in 1922. It retained quite a lot of British influence until the 1950s. A lot of British history in the 1950s is around Egypt and the Suez Crisis and everything like that.
Yeah.
Where Egypt finally became a republic at that point. And then Ethiopia, which is an incredibly old country, at least 2,000 years old, under various names, has never been fully colonized. It was occupied by Italy briefly and brutally in the 1940s during the war, but they didn't hang around. So yeah, the only other country which could claim to be vaguely independent was South Africa at that point, which was still a British dominion, I believe, at that point, similar to what we said about Australia, gained full independence like Australia in like the 1980s, or like Canada, I should say, in the 80s. But was still part of the United Kingdom, essentially, but really was an independent country. So, yeah, there's basically four countries.
How did Sudan fit into it?
Sudan gained its independence from sort of Egypt and sort of the United Kingdom. There was still heavy British, there's a lot of British troops still centered there, but I think it was officially part of Egypt. I think it was 1952, maybe 1956. Somewhere around then,
okay.
It gained its independence.
That makes a lot of sense.
I think it's 56.
Because
I think the Egyptian Revolution was 52. They became a republic at that point.
Okay, well, that makes a lot of sense because those, well, four of those five countries that you've mentioned were the only nations that were members of FIFA.
Indeed.
Because as of the start of 1956, there was no Confederation of African Football. It did not exist.
No.
It was created in that summer following a FIFA Congress in Lisbon.
Yeah. Yeah, there's interesting background to it, which is worth mentioning with regards to specifically to one of those four countries, which I've mentioned, and that one is South Africa. So,
Can I have a wild guess? Did apartheid play a role?
Yeah, it might have done. So, as I mentioned, the first matches in South Africa were around the 1860s. Big British influence, of course, in the early days. The first African football teams emerged in South Africa in the 1880s. They were followed by teams in Algeria and Egypt, which were in place by the start of the new century. Football spread then to the rest of the continent from the north and the south over the next 30 years or so. The first African Football Association, as in the first country to have a football association, was South Africa. That was the SAFA, the South African Football Association. I'll refer to them as SAFA because it's easy to say. That was founded as a, unsurprisingly, whites-only organization in 1882. So they joined FIFA in 1910. They left in 1924 and then rejoined later, and I'll come to that. The first black football association in Africa was founded again in South Africa in 1907, which represented black players in the Durban area of the country. This was followed by a few different South Africa-wide associations, which were the South African African Football Association, the South African Bantu Football Association, and the South African Coloured Football Association, which were founded in 1932, 1933. These united to form the South African Soccer Federation, the SASF, in 1951. That was an anti-apartheid federation, which was opposed to SAFA. So for a number of years, both those two organizations disputed over the right to pick the South African national team. One was backed by the government. I don't need to tell you which one that was. And one of them had all the players and all the teams and were much, much higher level of players and teams signed up to it. And that was obviously the SASF representing the black South Africans, of which I mentioned football was their most popular sport and remains to this day. Yeah. It's a hugely, hugely popular sport in South Africa.
This is sort of, I imagine, and I know we don't have time to do it on this episode, but we have spoken about rugby in the past, and I imagine this is where the diversion between the two communities probably started to really entrench.
Yeah, I would imagine so. So in 1954, the SASF tried to join FIFA. SAFA had rejoined FIFA in 1952. After 28-year absence, as I mentioned. While FIFA acknowledged that the white-only SAFA didn't have full standing due to their lack of players and clubs compared to their rival, the SASF's application was rejected specifically because they didn't have any white players. Obviously, this being a couple of years after SAFA got it back into FIFA, despite not having any non-white players. And that tells you everything you need to know about FIFA and Stanley Roux and many other things. I mean, the International Olympic Committee were just as bad at the time.
Obviously it's good that they're not as fundamentally racist as is being described, but they haven't really improved in terms of their levels of corruption. They've merely pivoted to another issue.
Yes. It was less, yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, like, what do you need to say about FIFA? Imagine everything that is bad and then instill it into an organization at its core and then watch it manifest across the sport that you love.
I didn't think FIFA could reach a new low after everything with Sepp Blatter and the shambles he left it in, but that draw reached a whole new low. And for anyone watching, I don't have to tell you why. Giving someone who is amounting to a war criminal a peace prize just because he would have thrown a paddy if he didn't, tells you everything you need to know about the organisation.
It does.
Politics.
Back to the development of African football.
Yeah, the next line of my notes is, FIFA were and have largely remained a bunch of twats.
Accurate.
I tell you how it is, Ben. In 1956, they accepted South Africa's, as in the South African government's argument, that segregation was, and I quote, a normal tradition and custom in South Africa, and allowed SAFA to continue as a representative of the South African football. While this is, so basically why this is all relevant, other than being very interesting history and very interesting history about football, around the same time, right on the back of the Continental Confederations being formed under FIFA in Europe and Asia with UEFA and the AFC founded in 1954. CONMEBOL had been around for about 40 years at this point. It preceded everyone by quite a long distance. So they were founded in 1954. Around that same time, Africa had been recognized by a vote of 24-17, which is a surprisingly close vote, considering this is just a recognition of the fact that it should be its own separate entity under FIFA. That's basically all it was. So in the 1954 FIFA Congress, it was recognized as a separate football zone, and plans were afoot to create a continental governing body, which, as you correctly mentioned, in June 1956, at the FIFA Congress in Lisbon, the Confederation of African Football was proposed and accepted, and immediately plans were drawn up for a continental tournament to be held in February 1957.
Known as.
So there was known as the African Cup of Nations. There was no need for a qualifying tournament because there was only four
of them.
Countries in it.
Yeah.
However, unlike FIFA, those other three countries got a say as to whether or not South Africa should be allowed to take part in this first tournament. And unsurprisingly, Africa were a horribly racist country who refused to pick anyone who wasn't white in their national team, they said, "Now we're good.
Yeah, you're not
and
coming."
Went ahead without them.
And it was hosted by Sudan in Khartoum.
It was, yeah. There's only two matches. It was just a semi-final and a final. Ethiopia were drawn against South Africa in their semi-final. They got a bye to the final.
Yeah.
Both matches were played at the municipal stadium in Khartoum, Sudan, in February 1957. Without South Africa, Ethiopia got a bye to the final, where they were joined by Egypt, who beat the host nation 2-1, before Egypt again triumphed, beating Ethiopia 4-0. Yeah. With four goals from a man named Mohamed Diab Al-Attar, who is better known simply as Adiba. Fun fact about Adiba, he later became a referee, and he actually refereed the final of the 1968 Cup of Nations when Congo-Kinshasa defeated Ghana 1-0. That's Congo-Kinshasa, who later became Zaire, who were the first sub-Saharan African team to qualify for the World Cup in 1974 and are now known as the Democratic Republic of Congo. Just to go off on a few tangents. Yeah. I actually have another tangent I can go off about the Congo, but I'll come to that a bit later.
There's a lot of tangents in this because there's a lot that goes
so
on. Yeah, I mean, that is a super interesting backstory to this tournament, though. I think the same thing happened in 1959, 2 years later in the second tournament.
Did it?
Yeah, I think there were still only three. Yeah, it was Egypt, Sudan, and Ethiopia again, except this time it was a Sudan versus Egypt. Well, it was a round robin tournament, I think. They played like a group. Egypt won.
Yeah.
They played each other rather than having a bye. They've just a little tournament, like a single group.
Yeah. South Africa didn't actually appear in the African Cup of Nations until 1996.
Yeah.
Which is incredible. FIFA had selected the pro-apartheid SAFA to be their representative. They then, under pressure from the African nations primarily and other sort of countries around the world, as South African apartheid really started to have a spotlight shined upon it, kicked them out in 1961, only to then bring them back until they were kicked out in 1964 permanently. The IOC resisted, obviously, for a while, but eventually South Africa were boycotted entirely from sport. Yeah. For 20, 25 years. It's until 1996.
Yes. And they won on...
Well, until the early 90s.
They won on debut, didn't they?
Yeah, they were hosts as well, which is... This was 6 months after the Rugby World Cup as well, where famously South Africa, as this rainbow nation, won the Rugby World Cup. The famous image of Francois Pienaar receiving the trophy from Nelson Mandela, who was wearing a Francois Pienaar shirt.
Yeah.
I mean, similar story here. I mean, Nelson Mandela obviously is a massive football fan, always understood the power of football, its power to be a force for good. So yeah, they got to the final, played Tunisia in the final. This was a Bafana team with the likes of Mark Fish, Lucas Radebe, Sean Bartlett, as you mentioned, and the late great Phil Massinger, who I remember watching as a kid playing for Leeds United. 1-2-0. Mark Williams scored both the goals. Interesting tangent about Mark Williams. He was a former Cape Town child gang member who basically found his way out of that life by being so bloody good at football. Ended up playing for the national team, scored both goals in the final. So
nice.
Quite an appropriate goal scorer.
I was just having a little look at their run in that tournament. It was, to be fair, they got out of a hell of a group. They won a group containing Egypt, Cameroon, and Angola. They nice. Slapped Cameroon 3-0, beat Angola 1-0, and then lost 1-0 to Egypt, but still topped their group on goal difference. And then their knockouts were tough as well. They beat Algeria 2-1, Ghana 3-0, and then, as you say, triumphed against Tunisia.
Yeah.
But they are the glaring omission from the history of the African Cup of Nations because they're such a massive footballing nation now. The only African side to ever have hosted the World Cup. Yeah. And
for now.
And are having only won this once.
Yeah.
Yeah. Massive underperformers. They've made the final, well, they made the final in the next edition in 98, and they've come third twice in 2000 and 2003. But they really are like the one that sticks out like a sore thumb. But it's obvious why, and it's because of apartheid.
Yeah, they missed half their history. They had, I'm imagining, some superbly talented footballers who simply weren't allowed to play for the national team. And then a national team who weren't allowed to play anyone because they weren't prepared to let the full range of talent available to them into the team.
Mm.
And then they got better, of course, in the 90s, came out of it a completely different nation for the most part. I mean, still not a perfect nation, of course, but who is?
Yeah.
The problem is, obviously, the 90s and 2000s, they've come up against the likes of Cameroon, the likes of Egypt, and Nigeria as well, picking around the edges, and the Ivory Coast and Ghana, really strong teams emerging.
Yeah, I mean, there's a big five in the African Cup of Nations, really. You got Egypt, who you've already mentioned, winners of the first two tournaments. They have 7 titles. They've also got the most appearances, 26, because of their longevity.
First African team to appear at a World Cup as well. Although you'll remember 1930, they didn't appear at the 1930 World Cup. Do you remember why?
They missed the boat.
They did miss the boat, famously.
Quite literally.
It's not their fault. It's not like they were late or something or hungover or anything, obviously.
Bad weather.
They were in a storm.
Yeah,
bad weather delayed their first boat. They missed the boat to South America.
Yeah. But yeah, they're the guys that everyone is always gunning for because, as we said, they're the most successful. They're not just the most successful in terms of wins. I think they are the most successful in terms of places or finishes as well. They've come runners-up 3 times, 3rd 3 times, 4th 3 times, in actual fact.
And they're second favourites this year.
Current hosts are Côte d'Ivoire and Ivory Coast, who have 3 titles. Along with Nigeria. Nigeria, like, we have a mate who's Nigerian.
We do.
Shout out to Sadiq, who we went to school with, who's a massive football fan, Chelsea fan. I hadn't appreciated fully the heartbreak that Sadiq has suffered at the hands of the African Cup of Nations. They have won it 3 times, most recently in 2013, but they've been runners-up 5 times, including in...
often to Cameroon, yeah.
Yeah, including...
arch rivals.
Yeah. They were runners-up last time to the Ivory Coast. They've come 3rd 8 times, and they've never come 4th. So that basically means that if they make a semi-final and win, they're odds on to lose in the final. And if they lose in the semis, then they'll almost certainly batter whoever they play in the 3rd 4th playoff. But they have a great record. Yeah. In terms of finishes, I think that puts them... they have the joint highest number of placings, so to speak, along with Egypt. But the other two big dogs are Cameroon and Ghana, who you already met. 5-4 apiece, Cameroon edging it.
Just a word about Ivory Coast victory in the last edition, in, well, 2024, but the 2023 edition. They only got out of their group stage because it is a 24-team tournament. And obviously, if you come third in your group, the best 4 third place teams get out. They had a -3 goal difference and on 3 points, but they managed to get through basically because I think it was Ghana blew a 2-0 lead in stoppage time, conceding 2 late goals. So they missed out on a win, which would have put them, would have knocked the Ivory Coast down to 5th best third place team and would have knocked them out. They then scraped through a second round match on penalties, quarterfinal against Mali in extra time. Won a semi-final 2-1, I think, and then they got to the final. Maybe, I think, 1-0 they scraped the semi-final and got to the final. And yeah, as you say, beat Nigeria 2-1. They were 1-0 down, came back to win. So it doesn't matter how you win it.
Yeah, they
just win it.
Isn't that the tournament where they had absolute chaos? They like sacked their manager And then they had someone standing in.
Probably.
I'm sure that's what made it one of those great stories. Because they were hosts. Yeah, they replaced their head coach mid-tournament. Yeah. Absolutely banana stuff. Like, crazy.
You'll love to see it.
Yeah.
It worked.
They did it, as you say. It's all about getting over the line. Quarterfinals in extra time. Semifinals 1-0. And then the final, yeah. They came from 1-0 down to win 2-1. Sebastian Haller.
Haller, indeed. Of West Ham fame. I'm not sure it's West Ham fame is a fair way of putting it, because he's better than everywhere else.
Borussia Dortmund.
Indeed.
Also survivor of testicular cancer, isn't he?
He is, yeah. Yeah, I knew that was nagging me. I knew there was something else of note about him. Very big note. Cancer survivor, currently at Utrecht, where we ended up once on the train.
Yes, trying to get to the Amsterdam Arena. And then going past it at about 110 miles an hour on a high-speed train, realizing that at that point we might have got on the wrong service. Yeah, that was it was a good day. Well, I don't know. Like, I hadn't appreciated this either, mate. Is AFCON the most hotly contested confederation tournament? Because there's been 21 different teams make the final.
Yeah.
In addition to the nations that we've just mentioned, Algeria and Democratic Republic of Congo have two each. And then you also have 8 one-time winners, including Senegal, South Africa, Morocco, Tunisia, Sudan, Ethiopia, Congo, and Zambia, who we will return to.
Surprised by a couple of them. Surprised that Morocco particularly have only won it once.
Yeah.
They're the favourites this year.
Yeah, Mali, Burkina...
Obviously hosting the tournament.
Yes, they are. Mali, Burkina Faso, Uganda, Guinea, Libya, and Equatorial Guinea have all made a final as well. And the 70s had 6 different winners.
Yeah, I think obviously it helps. It's a biannual.
Course.
Biennial? Whichever it is. Once every 2 years tournament. That helps. I don't know. I mean... I'm trying to think of the European Championship. I mean, the good thing about the European Championship is over the years there's been a couple of surprise winners in Greece and
Denmark,
maybe Czechoslovakia and Denmark, certainly. Czechoslovakia in the 70s.
Portugal.
Arguably. Portugal was, I mean, again, they came third in their group and would have been knocked out in any reasonable tournament. But, you know, we got to win it.
Yeah.
And they won it.
Yeah, that's it. But, like... I don't know, to put it a different, let me spin it another way then. So rather than talking about like your likelihood of winning it if you qualify, there's only 10 nations that haven't qualified for the tournament at some point in their history.
Yeah.
And they are, some of them are very small. So you've got Central African Republic, which is not small, it's massive. Chad, Djibouti, Eritrea, Eswatini, Lesotho, Sao Tome and Principe, I think that's how you pronounce it, Seychelles, Somalia, and South Sudan. They're the only nations.
South Sudan are brand new.
Yeah. They're the only ones who've never qualified. Like that, you can't say that about Europe. Maybe there are some smaller nations in the likes of like Asia or, well, no, Australia now compete in that, don't they? I was going to say in Oceania.
Yeah.
Where you might have sort of similar island nations having not qualified. But like that's like Africa's a big continent. It's got a lot of countries in it. Like to only have 10 never have been represented in the tournament, I think is very impressive.
Yeah. And for a lot of the tournament's history, it was only 8 teams in it. It was only 1992, it increased to 12. And then 1996, it was meant to increase to 16. But Nigeria were withdrawn under pressure from its military dictator at the time, yeah. Sani Abacha. Yeah.
16-team tournament from 98, wasn't it, officially?
Yeah. Although it's been 15 a couple of times that time, and then 2010 as well.
Yeah.
With Togo.
Togo, yeah.
Is it worth mentioning that now?
It is worth mentioning that for a couple of reasons. We'll start with the sad, I guess, which is Togo.
Yeah.
But also it's the tournament at which Egypt won their third title, which should have entitled them to keep the trophy.
Well, their third title in a row.
The third title in a row, sorry. They're the only third time
they'd won that particular trophy,
The only... you're explaining it much better than I am. The third time that trophy had been won by them and third time in a row, which in previous editions of the tournament where there have been other trophies, anyone who's won it 3 times gets to keep it. Egypt being the only nation to have ever won it 3 times in a row, weren't allowed to. They were given a replica. Yeah.
Mm.
And the trophy that they won is still the trophy that everyone competes for at AFCON now.
Probably too much gold in it to give it away.
Yeah, it's very gold. It's gold plated.
It's very gold.
Yeah, I mean, they beat Ghana 1-0 in a tournament hosted by Angola, and I guess that's where we can pick up the Togo story.
Yeah, so the geography, I guess it is, of Angola is quite strange. There's a small strip of the Democratic Republic of Congo, which basically gives Congo a single port in the Atlantic, and it cuts off a tiny bit of Angola, which is an area called Cabinda, the province of Cabinda. Now, Cabinda is a very oil-rich little area, and obviously, therefore, has had certain amounts of separatist movements and various ideologies at play there. Things had calmed down a little bit by sort of the mid-2000s, and this was 2010, obviously. However, the Togo team took a bus from they were going from the Democratic Republic of Congo into Cabinda at this point. They just crossed the border when they were set upon by a small Cabindan separatist group, which is called the Front for the Liberation of the Enclave of Cabinda. And unfortunately, they opened fire on the bus with automatic weapons in an attack that lasted half an hour.
Yeah, that's terrifying.
Absolutely terrifying. So yeah, three people on board the bus were killed, which was the bus driver, a man named Mario Azua, a journalist called Stanislav Oklu, who was a Togolese TV journalist, and then Amaleti Abalo, who was the Togo team's assistant coach. They all unfortunately killed, as well as multiple injuries, most significantly to Kajovi Obalali, who was a goalkeeper who was shot in the lower back, and that unfortunately ended his career.
Yeah, well, he's still
got very sad
bullet fragments in his stomach, which they couldn't remove.
He does, yeah.
Which is pretty crazy. Medical staff, managers were also injured as well, weren't they, I think?
Yeah.
Yeah.
To any English football fans, the most famous player you'd have heard of who was on the bus was Emmanuel Adebayor, who described it as one of the worst things he'd ever been through in his life, which is a really worrying use of the words one of.
Yeah, I know.
Because
yeah.
I think for most of us, that would be a clear first. Obviously, that might have just been what he said.
Yeah, just a turn of phrase.
I don't want to assume, but yeah, that's... it sounds like the most terrifying thing most people would go through.
Yeah. And how did CAF react to this? Because, you know, they seem like they make reasonable and proportional decisions in the wake of tragedy.
Oh, I can't even be... like, okay. I tried my best to, like, dig into what the details of this were, whether there were, warnings given or anything like that. But basically, this was 3 days before Togo were meant to play their first match of the tournament. They basically went home straight away, fearing for the safety of the team.
They withdrew. The players decided they weren't going to play, right? It was a player decision first and foremost.
Exactly. Which is, I mean, if you don't feel safe, the football certainly comes second.
Yeah.
However, they didn't withdraw from the whole competition. They were kicked out of it. Having missed their first match, they were disqualified.
Yeah. Because the players had also decided, some of them had decided to reverse their decision to withdraw. Interesting.
Yes.
They wanted to carry on playing, come back and carry on playing. And so in that context, the Togolese government did what, Jack? They sought...
incredible.
...some assurances that people aren't going to shoot their bus up.
So they went to CAF and, as you say, sought some assurances. Those assurances weren't forthcoming. They'd also requested a period of mourning and for the match to be delayed. And even if it wasn't delayed, for them just to be able to pick up from the second match. But yeah, essentially... CAF not only kicked them out of the tournament, they banned them for the next two tournaments. Provisionally banned them, I should say. So, yeah, the Togo FA had to go to the Court of Arbitration for Sport, and Sepp Blatter had to get involved, which, if Sepp Blatter is in a morally better position than you are, you know you're probably in the wrong.
Yeah.
Message to CAF.
The judgment is certainly going to be called into question.
Yeah.
I thought that the reasoning was hilarious, that it was for government interference in the withdrawal from a tournament.
Okay.
It's like, right, so they told their football team to come home because they had been subject to a terrorist attack and asked for your security assurances and you declined them.
I would sure as hell, if that happened to the England football team, I would sure as hell hope the British government got involved in some respect. And ensured the safety of the players, spectators, whoever.
Yeah, crazy stuff.
You'd hope, wouldn't you?
You would. I mean, the tournament did roll on. And as you've already said, it would eventually be won by Egypt.
Yeah.
Yeah. If anybody, we said that's the third time that they won it in a row. If anybody's thinking, like, what's the big deal? That's only been done by Argentina, Mexico, and Iran to have won their own confederation tournament. Is it a confederation? Am I naming it correctly?
Yeah, confederation.
Yeah.
Yeah, continental tournament, continental, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, three times in a row. They're the only Argentina, Mexico, and Iran have done it along with Egypt. So it's very difficult.
There's only been three teams to have won two in a row as well, one of which was Egypt earlier in the existence of the competition. Ghana did it in the 1960s, and I'll mention Ghana in the 1960s in a second. And then Cameroon, as you mentioned.
Because they were electric.
Cameroon tie with Ataro, Jeremy, Patrick Mbomber, Mark Vivian Foe, of course.
Vivian Foe, yeah.
Who sadly lost his life in 2003.
In the Confederations
Cup.
Yeah.
Yeah, on the pitch.
Remember it. It was on TV. It was crazy.
It's happened a few times since, unfortunately. And it did happen before that, but not to someone so high profile that, obviously, professional sportsmen with undiagnosed heart defects dying or nearly dying in a couple of cases.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty crazy that, I mean, I guess it's because as the sport intensifies, becomes more professional, the running goes up. If it's undetected or it's latent, it's very easily missed, overlooked. You're not normally looking for very serious medical conditions in professional athletes who are at the peak of their physical ability.
Yeah. I mean, fortunately, screening for that sort of thing has improved as well on the back of some of these incidents, unfortunately. But yeah. It's been a few.
Yeah. Just to take us back onto some fun trivia about the tournament, since we're doing multiple winners and stuff, and to uplift us and not just talk about death and terrorist attacks.
Please, yeah.
Only three teams have won on debut as well. Egypt, Ghana, and South Africa, who we've already spoken about. But Ghana...
I was going to say, Egypt, you're being very generous about. They played two games in 1957.
Yeah, they won the first one. We've spoken about that, and we've spoken about South Africa, and you said you want to talk about Ghana, so I'm leading you in, mate. Just let me do my thing.
Hit me, go.
So you said Ghana won two in a row in 63 and 65 in the 60s. You were right. 63 also happened to be their debut. You wanted to tell us a bit more about Ghana in the 60s. Here is your opportunity.
I just wanted to mention one guy who's not even African, but I just wanted to mention him because I was looking at the 1968 final, which was what is now the Democratic Republic of Congo. They've had a few names since then. As I mentioned, there was Zaire for between like 71 and 97. Qualified for World Cup as Zaire, famously the first sub-Saharan African country to qualify for the World Cup. I had that famous incident where the free kick, Zaire player ran out the wall and kicked it away and got a yellow card for his troubles, if you recall. So I was looking at the 1968 final, and the manager of the Ghana team popped out at me. It was Carlos Alberto Pereira, who was 24 years old at the time, who would later go on to coach Brazil at two World Cups, including winning in 1994, and also is one of only two managers to have ever coached in five World Cups, alongside Bora Milutinovic, who coached the USA most famously in 1994. But he coached, as in... Carlos Alberto Pereira coached Kuwait in 1982, UAE in 1990, Brazil 94, Saudi Arabia in 1998, where he also got sacked mid-tournament, one of only three managers to ever been sacked in the middle of the World Cup. And then more relevantly, and worth mentioning in this context, he also coached South Africa at the 2010 World Cup, which they hosted. That's a crazy managerial career.
Yeah, mainstay.
He's 24 years old in 1968, managing Ghana. Yeah, incredible.
That is incredible, to be fair.
Yeah. And he managed Brazil again in 2006, where they lost in the quarterfinals to a France team inspired by one Zinedine Zidane, who was one of the best games of football, single performances I've ever seen, him against Brazil in 2006. There's my Zidane reference. I just wanted to mention him.
Well, you did it very nicely, actually. You managed to weave it back in very smoothly, yeah. But you've not left us with a transition to the next phase of the discussion. I know there are two tournaments that I want to talk about, one of which overlaps with the tournament that you want to talk about. So maybe we should go there first and talk about tragedy and fairy tales intertwining.
Yeah.
Because, mate, football.
Football. Astonishing.
Me and you are romantic about sport. We say this virtually every single time we talk about anything that sort of gets our juices going when it comes to sport. I don't think I've come across too many stories quite as astonishing as this one.
Yeah, quite as deeper lows and higher highs as this one.
And also just like the sorts of details and coincidence and circumstance that lead you to believe that maybe there is something going on that's dictating a destiny or something. Because if you wrote this story, if this wasn't a real story, if this was written in a fictional book, it would come off as preposterous. And it's not unique in that sense, but as we tell it, I'm sure it will become very apparent as to why we form that view. So do you want to start us off?
Yeah, well, the ending of this is one of the happiest I've ever been as a essentially neutral football fan. I was bouncing off the walls when this happened, but the story really starts off in the late 1980s, I'd say, for this one, because in 1988, for the very first time, Zambia had qualified for the Olympics, and while at the Olympics, they defeated Italy 4-0 in the group stage. Which is quite an incredible result, as you can imagine. The man of the match against the Italians was one, Kalusha Boalia. He was playing for Cercle Bruges in Europe at the time. He later went on to have a successful spell with Bobby Robson at PSV Eindhoven.
Yeah.
And another successful spell in Mexico for Club America, where he once finished 12th in a FIFA World Player of the Year vote, just to show how good he was. So just pointing out that this was a very up-and-coming Zambian team.
It's also important that people remember Kalusha because his contract with PSV Eindhoven would be a very significant part of this story.
Indeed.
By chance.
Yeah. Yeah, by chance and fortune. So Zambia had finished third at the 1990 Cup of Nations. They'd lost to Nigeria in the semis, beat Senegal in the third place playoff. They could only reach the quarterfinals in 1992, which was a very disappointing result. They lost to the eventual winners, which was the Ivory Coast, 1-0 after extra time. Their qualifying campaign for the 1994 World Cup had started very well.
Very well.
There was only three African qualifiers at the time. Obviously, there's many more now. There's nine now, I think, mm-hmm. if I'm right in saying. Big improvement, especially with the expanded World Cup. They'd won their first round group on goal difference in a strong group. They went well to win that. They were drawn against Morocco and Senegal in their second qualifying group. Yeah, very tough. Only the group winners were getting through as well. So basically, if they won their group of three, they'd qualify. Mm-hmm. They were due to start their campaign away in Senegal.
Here we go. This is where things start to take a turn.
Yeah, a very, very dark turn. Basically, to get the players from Zambia, the Zambian-based players primarily, as well as a few players who'd come in to Zambia, a Zambian Air Force de Havilland Canada DHC-5D Buffalo with the tail number AF319 was obtained from the Zambian...
Good attention to detail.
Thank you. I don't know why I've got all that written down. It was obtained from the...
Zambian Air Force.
From the Zambian Air Force, yeah. And unfortunately, it was on a multi-leg flight because it needed to stop for refueling.
On three occasions.
Yeah, it has stopped on the final occasion in Libreville, Gabon. And on takeoff from Libreville Airport, it crashed into the Atlantic Ocean, killing everyone on board.
Yeah, it's
bad. 30 passengers, 25 passengers and 5 crew.
Yeah.
All died.
It's a real tragedy, this, because in the first stop in Brazzaville, They noted that there were problems with the engine. Despite that, they allowed the flight to continue. After their stop in Libreville, the engine caught fire on takeoff, and then the pilot, who I think it was later found he was fatigued because of how much he had been flying, he mistakenly shut down the wrong engine.
Yeah, shut down the right engine, not the left engine,
which meant that the plane lost all power and crashed only 500 meters. Offshore. There was almost certainly like some faulty instruments and stuff, but it's a genuine tragedy because there was an opportunity to avert the disaster, but such is the way of
it was an aircraft that was known to be dodgy as well. It'd been out of service for months.
It had, at that point. Yeah, it was like 5 months. Yeah. It hadn't been flown or something.
Just come back just before the trip. And checks before departure found defects, including signs of the engine issue, but the flight still went ahead.
Yeah, crazy.
So, yeah.
The consequence of that is that basically 18 players, the coach and the support staff were all killed in the 30 people on board the flight. But not so, every player was killed.
No, as you mentioned, as per the stipulations of his contract, Kalusha Boualia flew directly or was planning to fly directly to Senegal for the match. So he was not on board the flight, as were a few other players who were based in Europe.
Yeah.
So to this day, Boualia's I think he's the third highest scorer in Zambian football history. And unfortunately, the first two scorers ahead of him were both coaches of the team at the time and were on board the flight.
Oh, really? I mean, yeah.
So it's like a national... they were retired players, but they were legends.
Yeah, well, I mean, that makes a lot of sense because there was, in response to this tragedy, because it was a national tragedy, there was a week-long period of mourning declared by the government. And then the members of the national team, those that were recovered at least, because I don't think everyone was able to be recovered.
24 bodies were recovered, out of 30.
They were buried back home just outside the Independence Stadium in Lusaka, in a location known as the Heroes Acre.
Yeah, it's a good name. But yeah, those two ex-players who are now coaches were Godfrey Chitilau, who scored 79 goals in 111 appearances between 1968 and 1980, which is quite the record, I think you'll agree.
Mm.
And then Alex Chola, who scored 43 in 102. Boualia ended up with 39 in 87, which is still a pretty meaty record and still third to this day. But yeah, unfortunately, both of them lost their lives too.
Has a lot of similarities to the Munich air disaster.
Yeah.
And particularly in the way in which Zambia rose like a phoenix from the ashes.
They were so close to, actually very similar to Manchester United. Manchester United, on the back of the Munich air crash, made it to the the European Cup final that year, but lost in the final.
Yeah,
but what can Zambia you do? Were 1 point away from qualifying for the World Cup.
Yeah, they missed out to Senegal, didn't they?
Yeah, it is a fair assumption that had this not happened, the team would have been strong enough to carry them to the USA.
Sorry, it wasn't Senegal they missed out on. It was Morocco who...
Yeah, it's Morocco, place. Yeah.
Sorry. My mistake. But, I mean, yeah, okay, so there's the doom and the gloom. But, you know, without being heartless about this, the show goes on. And a new side had to be assembled. The African Cup of Nations was just around the corner.
It was 1994 African Cup of Nations.
They were drawn in Group C.
They were drawn in Group C. Are you taking from here? You've got this.
Alongside the Ivory Coast and Sierra Leone. And what did they go and do? They went and defied the odds. They resurrected the team. They displayed the kind of courage and fight that you would probably come to expect from a Zambian side in these circumstances. They played some good stuff, apparently, as well. I mean, obviously, I was too young to have watched it firsthand. Despite their bigging up their style, they actually sort of got through the group fairly unspectacularly. They won it, but with a 0-0 draw against Sierra Leone and a 1-0 win over the Ivory Coast, which got them a quarterfinal against Senegal, of all teams, who you'll remember were traveling crazy to play at the time of the crash. They beat them. See you later, Senegal. Now we're in the semis and we're up against Mali. And Mali take a slapping. They get walloped 4-0. And so all of a sudden, against all the odds, despite the fact that they went through a national tragedy, you know, less than a year earlier, had lost their entire team, save for three or four guys, they're in the final against Nigeria. And Sadiq, what did your home nation go and do? They went and pooped the party. So Zambia took the lead inside 3 minutes, but the Super Eagles themselves were obviously gunning for an African Cup of Nations title. They equalised in the 5th minute and followed up with a winner just after halftime and won 2-1. So in spite of the loss, the Zambian side obviously returned home as national heroes. And there you might think the story ends.
Oh, if the story ended there, it would still be a hell of a story.
But it didn't. Would be wrong. Horribly mistaken.
It was a hell of a Nigerian side. Sorry to go off topic. I'm just like looking through it. Hell of a Nigerian side. Sunday, Elise, Fanidi George, JJ Okocha, Daniel Amakachi. Anyway, I digress.
That's a serious outfit, isn't it? No wonder they got it done. But to return to our Zambian heroes. Right. Again, it's hard to overemphasize this. One of the weird twists of fate that only sport can conjure up. In 2012, Zambia go to the Gabon, to Libreville, to the African Cup of Nations, just a few hundred meters inland from the site of the crash. Where
it's incredible.
They go and win the damn thing. They obviously dedicate it in the memory of the teammates.
Massive underdogs as well.
Big underdogs playing the Cote d'Ivoire, the Ivory Coast, the mighty Ivory Coast in the final. And they pull their pants 8-7 in a penalty shootout after a 0-0. And
so happy.
The full circle is complete. Like, yeah, the phoenix rises. That's just beautiful stuff, man. Like, I don't know.
It's sport.
Yeah, it's sport.
It's sport doing sport things. I mean, it's wonderful. I mean, it's a horrible tragedy. It's an unimaginable tragedy that can't even begin to imagine how that feels as a nation, as players, as like a collective identity. But then to go out and fight back, and within a year to nearly win it all, then to regroup and to go away and brought back to the site of which, I mean, you can see probably from the top of the stadium, you can probably see the spot in the ocean where they went down. And yeah. Just to put that to the back. Well, I don't know if you put that to the back of your mind or bring it to the forefront of your mind. I don't know.
Yeah.
But whatever they did, they battled hard. I remember it being a crazy 0-0 draw. It was one of those games where it felt like fate was
intervening.
On the side.
Yeah.
Like, crazy shootout, crazy game.
In the shootout, Zambia missed first, Caliber, and then Kolo Touré missed, and then Sun Tzu scored, and then Jovinho missed. But yeah.
Jovinho missed, just like he was missing his hairline.
That, I mean, again, though, that Ivory Coast side.
A hell of an Ivory Coast team.
It was unbelievable, mate. Drogba.
Didier Zakore. Yaya Touré. Cheick Tiote, the late great Cheick Tiote, scorer of the greatest equaliser in Premier League history, yeah. Though you might disagree. Solomon Kalou.
Yeah, Kalou.
Max Gradle. Wilfred Bony.
Zakora.
Sol Bamba. For any Leeds United fans out there, the legend is Sol Bamba.
Dumbia, Seydou Dumbia, Emmanuel Aboué, Max Gradle.
Max Gradle as well, he was a Leeds player.
Yeah. It was that was an incredible Ivory Coast side. Like, so yeah, it just adds to the beauty of the story, really, to overcome not just the statistical odds, but also the sporting ones.
Of course they were going to win. Of course they were going to win.
The benefit of hindsight, we can all say it was bloody obvious the moment the plane went down. No, like you said, it's one of those things where when you look back on a story like that, you never want bad things to happen, but if they are going to happen, it's nice to know that sometimes it can be the trigger for a pretty remarkable, wonderful, uniting story.
Indeed.
Yeah. But I mean, you can't really better that story. So the only other thing I want to tell a story about, or tell you about, is just because it emphasizes a little bit how crazy CAF can be, is the 2015 edition, which was supposed to be hosted in Morocco, but wasn't.
Mm.
All because of a rather significant outbreak of the Ebola virus.
And you don't get those sort of problems in Europe, do you?
Oh, mate. Is
in the European Championships.
It's pretty crazy. So, like, the 2013-2016 Ebola epidemic, I think it was known as. I don't know if it became a pandemic because I don't think it was global enough. Epidemic to West Africa was bad. It's the worst outbreak of Ebola that there's ever been. The 2015 AFCON was being hosted, as I said, by Morocco. And in October 2014, so it's literally slap bang in the middle of the epidemic, the government of Morocco suggested and requested that maybe the tournament ought to be postponed. Not an unreasonable request, in my view.
I can see their reasoning.
Yeah.
Especially given what happened 5 years later with every tournament in 2020 quite sensibly getting postponed.
Yeah, and if you want...
It seems crazy to think.
If you want some additional context to compare it to COVID, because that's the, you know, I imagine that's where a lot of people's minds will go. And some people may even be thinking, oh, why are these two banging on about, like, you know, the significance of COVID or the Ebola outbreak? Because, you know, COVID weren't that bad, and maybe it was an overreaction to cancel everything. I mean, firstly, it's a misunderstanding of the stats, but we won't get into that. What we will say is that Ebola has a mortality rate of up to 90%.
And not a pleasant mortality.
No.
Not a nice way to go.
It is a savage disease. It is one of the deadliest viruses known to man. Its average mortality rate is 50%. So certain strains of the virus kill up to 90% of the people they infect. Most kill 50%. It can be as low as 25%, but that means one in four people who get it dies, not gets ill.
It's a terrible disease, and it's weird that as a human race, we are fortunate that it is so fatal because it stops it spreading.
It does. Well, it does. It does in the sense that it can only spread by touch, and it's not airborne. It's not spread like aerosol particles either. So,
you
can't cough it into the air and then breathe it in,
like COVID is.
Yeah. So that slows it down. And then generally speaking, it does kill people quite quickly, and its incubation period is only 2 days. However, in Morocco's defense, it can be as long as 21 days. It's usually between 4 and 10. So with this disease having broken out and with that kind of mortality rate, you can understand why they had reservations about welcoming the whole of Africa to their country.
Yes.
Again, some more numbers, because I'm just a geek and I hope it contextualizes things here. Between 1976 and 2012, according to the World Health Organization, there had only been 24 outbreaks of Ebola, but they had resulted in a total of 2,387 cases, of which 1,590 people, 66%, died. So it's not
rough.
It's not it's just not a disease to mess about with. Anyway, the relevance is that we're saying it was a West African epidemic. The important thing to note here is that it mainly impacted Guinea, Sierra Leone, Liberia, but also Mali, Senegal, and Nigeria. By the end of this epidemic, 28,616 people had been infected and 11,310 had died. So 40% of people who had caught the disease. All football activity in Liberia had been suspended. And in fact, their national stadium in Monrovia had been converted into an Ebola treatment unit. So CAF discussed the matter at an executive committee meeting in November, and they decide the tournament shall go on. The show must go on. Keep in mind, Senegal, Mali, and Guinea have qualified for the tournament, where the outbreak is either strong or certainly impacting the nation.
Yeah.
Keep also in mind that Mali and Guinea are later drawn into the same group. So
yeah.
So they turn around to say, the show goes on, and they say to Morocco, what do you reckon about that then? You going to still host it? And depending on who you believe, Morocco didn't respond in time. So CAF stripped Morocco of the tournament, asked Egypt, Ghana, South Africa, and Sudan if they would host it independently of one another, not jointly. And they all said no. So they eventually found
sensible.
The Equatorial Guinea, who were prepared to host it. Not a bad choice.
It should be pointed out that Equatorial Guinea is nowhere near Guinea.
No, it's not. Yeah, it's
they're a few thousand miles apart.
Geographically, it's not a terrible choice.
No,
if you were basing it on that, I think they really only got it though because they were the only people prepared to host it, and they'd also hosted the 2011 edition, so they'd recently had, you know, the infrastructure, etc.
Fair enough.
But anyway, CAF weren't finished there. They weren't finished with Morocco. No, they basically decided to take some legal action against Morocco for breach of contract, and basically said that they were refusing to host the tournament, and the Moroccan sports minister, a chap called Mohamed Ouzine, said that that was false, and in actual fact, they had just asked for it to be postponed, which, based on everything that seems to be publicly available, is a more accurate telling of this story. They also said it was justified because, you know, a small organization known as the World Health Organization had said that it was probably advisable.
I've heard of them.
And that obviously you're allowed to make decisions in the best interest of the health of your population. Oh, God. Anyway, CAF.
Sounds like sports and politics mixing, Ben.
Yeah.
You know we don't like that.
Did they stop there, though, Jack? No, of course they didn't stop there. They banned Morocco from the next two AFCON tournaments and fined them $1 million and demanded $9 million in compensation. And Morocco went, have you guys lost your minds? We're going to go to the Court of Arbitration for Sport again. And CAS, well,
CAS ruled in Morocco's favour, so CAF went 0-2 in the Court of Arbitration for Sport.
Do you reckon there's lawyers working at CAS who just hate it whenever a CAF case comes into their desk? They're just like, oh, for God's sake, not again.
What have they done this time?
What are they doing this time? Oh, they're trying to sue someone for not wanting to expose their country to Ebola. And now they're trying to sue someone for pulling out of a match because they'd just be gunned down by terrorists.
Yeah, I know.
Jesus.
Absolutely insane. A very funny organization. You know, no better or worse than UEFA or Cannon Bowl.
No, and, all have their moments.
They all have their time on this podcast. Don't you worry, ladies and gentlemen.
Mm-hmm.
And FIFA, we know full well our views on FIFA. But all things, all things considered, the tournament actually went off without incident. The Ivory Coast beat Ghana in the final. You could argue one interpretation of that is that they were right to run the tournament. Maybe so, but that feels like captain hindsight. And at the time, it seems like a very, very bold risk to have taken. But I just thought that was really funny. I thought it was a funny story with a happy ending where no one actually gets hurt. And it illustrates very nicely what governing bodies, how this sport is run, really.
Yeah. I mean, I'm speechless. I genuinely didn't know the details of that story. I'd skip by that in my research. That has genuinely left me speechless.
It's bizarre, isn't it? It's really bizarre. But yeah, I mean, I guess that leaves us with this year's tournament.
Indeed.
Morocco.
Yeah, Morocco actually hosting it this time, given there's no ongoing epidemics I'm aware of.
It's a nice little transition again. See, we're on form today. We've come prepared. Yeah, it's going to be hosted in Morocco. There's going to be some massive names. Sunderland are going to be afflicted quite badly.
Indeed, yeah.
They're losing a lot of players.
As are quite a lot of other Premier League teams, as is always the case. But
Arsenal are not. It's one of the few times in Arsenal's history where we don't have an African player representing us, which is they were discussing it on the Arsecast podcast, and they were saying how unusual that is.
That is unusual. You are correct. Yeah, yeah.
But
and Liverpool are slightly less effective than we used to be. Obviously, still losing Salah, but you know,
recent events maybe make that less pointed. I mean, it's a tournament that sometimes dishes up goals deluxe. Not as many as the 1962 tournament, which averaged 4.5 goals a game, mind.
Yeah, some of the early tournaments are mad for goals.
Yeah, I mean, they were short, and so it was really the stats are distorted by a couple of slappings being handed down. But it is a tournament which normally does entertain. It didn't entertain in 1988, which was won by Cameroon. And it only averaged 1.44 goals a game. There was 8 teams in the tournament, but only 2 games had more than 2 goals all tournament. Most of them finished 1-0 or 1-1.
What year do you say that was? 88?
88, yeah.
That was a grim time for football, to be fair, because the 1990 World Cup was the lowest World Cup for goals ever.
Really? No, I didn't know that.
Well, why they got rid of the back pass rule, or why they brought in the back pass rule, I should say.
Okay.
Too much time being wasted, too little time with the ball in attacking situations. So obviously teams under pressure would just roll it back to the keeper,
yeah,
and then pass it around for a bit and then roll it back to the keeper who'd pick it up.
I mean, like, mate, it makes a lot of sense because Cameroon won 3 games in the 1-0 and then drew 0-0 and 1-1. Yeah, it was a rubbish tournament. There was a penalty shootout for the ages with Nigeria smashing Algeria 9-8 in the semis. Well, I think everybody took a pen, including the keepers. Yeah, hopefully this year's tournament is closer to 1962 than it is to 1988. Generally speaking, there have been goals, though, in the African Cup of Nations. And most of them have been scored by Samuel Eto'o. There you go, another nice little segue.
Go on, give me the numbers.
Top scorer, 18 in 29 across 6 tournaments. I think he's also the only dude to score in 6 consecutive tournaments. Was in an absolutely electric Cameroon team, as we have referenced many times. Patrick Mboma has 11 and 17 across 4 tournaments around the same time. So if you want a little taster of how their firepower was set up in the early 2000s, there you have it.
They were incredibly good, but they were the team that we were sort of friendshiply obligated to hate.
Yes.
At the same time,
mm-hmm.
with a Super such Eagles. A close friend from Nigeria. Yeah.
Yeah.
Obviously, bordering nations, rival nations, so often one defeating the other.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, often Cameroon defeating Nigeria.
as discussed about the number of titles that each nation has respectively. Good nicknames, though. The Indomitable Lions versus the Super Eagles.
Yeah, they don't mess around with the nicknames in Africa. Fantastic.
The only other name probably worth throwing out there for the purposes of goals is Laurent Pokou, who got 14 and 12 across four tournaments, with the exception of an Egyptian chap who played in the 70s, Hassan El Shazli, who got 12 and 8 across three tournaments. Pokou nice. Is the most deadly. He and El Shazli are the only two guys to average more than a goal a game in the tournament. So, yeah, it's a tournament for the netters.
It is, as all tournaments are. I mean, it's a tournament where you can rack up a lot of goals because, as we mentioned, it's every 2 years.
Every 2 years.
Twice as many tournaments. Twice the fun.
Twice the fun indeed.
I am looking forward to it. I really am looking forward to it. It is always super entertaining.
Yeah. There's some good groups. Morocco, Mali and Zambia are all in the same group. Egypt, South Africa, Angola.
Nice.
Nigeria, Tunisia. They have a fairly decent draw. They've got Uganda and Tanzania in Group C. Senegal will be happy with their group. Group D is Democratic Republic, Congo, Benin and Botswana. Algeria, Burkina Faso, Equatorial Guinea and Sudan in E. And then F is a biggie, actually. You've got Ivory Coast, Cameroon, Gabon and Mozambique. So Mozambique, obviously big underdogs there, but Gabon, obviously still led by Pierre-Emerick.
Yeah. Indeed, yeah.
It's going to be a good tournament.
It will be. And where can we watch it?
Oh, that's a great question. Where is it shown here? Is it on Sky?
I reckon it'll be on BBC.
Oh, yes, I think you might be right. AFCON.
UK. It is often on BBC. Channel 4.
Channel 4.
So it's still free to air.
Yeah, YouTube as well, apparently.
Yeah, it is normally on free to air TV. Channel 4 in the UK, BN Sports in the USA, Supersport in South Africa, and on YouTube, yeah.
Nice.
That's all I can give you.
Well, I mean, yeah, tune in. Who are the favourites? Morocco as hosts? Presumably the usual
Morocco
suspects.
Morocco as hosts. Yeah, then Egypt, and then I don't know who's third. Outsiders, Botswana, 750-1, Zimbabwe, 500-1.
Oh, wow. I was only going to mention very quickly that Tunisia are on the longest consecutive appearances streak since 1994. This is their 17th appearance in a row, which is not being bettered. So
very impressive.
Yeah. Shall we leave AFCON there?
I think so. I think that's been pretty well covered.
Yeah.
Our last proper episode of the year.
Can I leave you with one small bit of trivia then about what happens if you win it?
Always.
You get 30 gold medals for the winning team, 30 silver medals for the runners-up, 30 bronze medals for the team ranked third, and then 30 diplomas if you come fourth, which is a bit weird.
Okay. Fair enough.
Yeah.
It's something you can stick on your wall.
Never known a tournament hand out.
I lost my last two games of the African Cup of Nations. Go me.
Yeah. So, AFCON, it will be fun. What are we going to do now that the Christmas period is upon us, Jack?
Well, we're going to have a break, but not until we've put out one more episode, which will be a bit of a summary of the year. A few, let's call them awards that we're going to be handing out.
Yeah, we're going to just
call it
a season in review.
Alternative.
Yeah.
Alternative sports personality of the year.
Yeah, it's a good way of putting it. A season in review, really just you and I chewing the fat over our favourite moments, who we think have had the best year, who the best team was, a couple of duds as well. The categories are up for debate. If anyone has any ideas or would like us to consider a question, fire it off. Why not? And we also might preview what we're going to cover in season two.
Season two in inverted commas,
In inverted commas. What's going to be kicking off the season? What we think the highlights are going to be? Maybe some predictions, which will inevitably be wrong. Yeah. Just as a nice little way to close out the festive period and take us into the new year.
I'm excited. It'll be a good way to end it. Might have a week off afterwards while we're a family. But then, yeah.
We go again.
Roll on 2026. We go again. Sport never stops, and neither do we.
Yeah. Cool. And I'm going to see you this weekend, which will be lovely.
Yes, you are, if I can ever arrange it.
All right, well then, see you this weekend.
See you this weekend.
Bye.
Thank you, as ever, for tuning in today. I hope you forgive me for taking a slightly different approach to the outro this week, to pay tribute to a man not entirely related to sport. Unless, of course, that sport is fencing, fighting, torture, revenge, giants, monsters, chases, escapes, true love or miracles. Rob Reiner created laughter and tears, dreams and nightmares, and some of the most memorable scenes in cinema history, being in courtrooms, delicatessens, railroad bridges, and storming castles alike. Rob and his wife Michelle will be missed, but the magic will live forever. We'll be back after Christmas with our review of 2025 and a few fun awards too. Until then, have a great festive period, surround yourself with people you love, and never forget that sport is nothing without the history that makes it. Merry Christmas.